Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson will be in Moscow tomorrow to meet with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. The trip has been on the calendar for quite a while. It occurs in the midst of Russian condemnation of U.S. missile attacks on a Syrian air base and an exchange of harsh words now between Mr. Tillerson and President Putin of Russia. President Trump ordered the missile launch, as you know, on Thursday night after the Syrian government used chemical gas on a Syrian village. We're turning to a journalist who spent a lot of time reporting in Syria. Janine DiGiovanni is the author of The Morning They Came for Us. And Janine, welcome. It's good to have you on the show again.
Good morning. It's good to be back.
Janine, I think one of the many unanswered questions about this gas attack is why al-Assad would be so brazen and provocative now. I mean, what the potential or possible strategy could be on this?
Look, it's impossible to know what's in his mind because so few people can really get close to him. But I think basically because he's winning. Or up until now, he was winning, and he had been allowed to get away with all kinds of crimes against humanity and war crimes with impunity. You know, think back to 2013 when the first gas attack happened, the first chemical attack happened in Ghouta. That was the red line. You remember President Obama, you know, said this would, and nothing happened. So I think that really emboldened him, and it empowered him to think, I can do anything, and the international community will not respond. And between 2013 and 2017, that's exactly what happened. The kind of crimes that were going on inside Syria, even in December, if you can think back to the fall of Aleppo, and what we've seen, or the 80 barrel bombs a day that are being dropped on people. So if he's gotten away with this, if you have the kind of psychology that you can do this over and over again, and no one's going to slap your wrists, no one's going to, you know, have airstrikes, no one's going to haul you off to a tribunal for war crimes, then you're going to do it to win the war. Now, what's been blurred all along is that this is a war against ISIS. And I think this is the reason many people all over the world get confused with Syria. And I totally understand it because it is very confusing. But I think Assad also capitalized on that. He, along with his Russian allies, their line, their strategy was, we are fighting ISIS and we're going to attack and get rid of this horrible Islamic fundamentalist group. But the fact was, they were hitting civilians. The Russian planes, I think there was an estimate of 60 targets were civilian targets, not to mention their attacks on doctors and hospitals and healthcare facilities. So, I mean, I think this is where the line got blurred with Assad. Well, I think that he felt... Sorry.
Janine, I was just going to say, this is a really good point, and I want to... about the confusion of just what... you know, who Assad and the Russians are fighting, because we can't forget that there is also a civil war, which when he is using chemical gas and he's dropping barrel bombs, he's dropping them on his own people because they're also in the midst of a civil war in which he wants to come out on top.
Absolutely. So this is where it gets really confusing. And again, I so sympathize with people on this because even I, and I'm, you know, an expert on, I've been following it since the very beginning. I work, you know, I've worked inside. I work with refugees. You know, often I have to put post-it notes up above my desk to work out, you know, which militia is which militia. So it's very confusing. So the situation is that, I mean, Assad and Putin, Vladimir Putin of Russia, have, you know, taken this very hard line on ISIS. Good. That is good. But the fact is, this war, we must never forget, came out of a popular uprising back in 2011 in the aftermath of the Arab Spring, where the other uprisings in Egypt, in Libya, in Tunisia, the Syrian people rose up as well because they wanted dignity. They wanted, it wasn't so much democracy, but what they wanted was dignity. They had lived under a dictatorship for 40 years, and they wanted to be free of it. So they rose up in peaceful demonstrations, which were triggered by some kids in the city of Dara, some teenagers that put graffiti on the wall that basically said, "Doctor, you are next." And that was a message to Assad, who is a doctor, of course, an ophthalmologist, saying, you know, look what happened to Mubarak of Egypt. Look what happened to Gaddafi of Libya. They went down and you're going to get it next. To punish them, Assad really hit hard. And he basically imprisoned these children. Some of them were tortured. And when they were released, the people rose up. So it started as a peaceful demonstration. People go into the mosque on Fridays and you know, calling out for change, as we would do in the U.S., you know, marching in Washington. Mm-hmm. What happened next was that they were brutally put down. Assad's big mistake here was, instead of doing negotiations or some kind of appeasement, he fired into the crowds. He began killing his own people. So I think what we often forget, and then it turned into a brutal armed conflict, which, you know, which is the narrative of my book. And in my book, I basically follow the stories of individual people and how they were led into the war and how it affected them. Now, I think that what got lost along the way is, in 2012, as a reporter, my colleagues and I first started seeing the beginning of ISIS in northern Syria. Mm-hmm. ISIS was basically allowed to flourish because President Obama, who I have huge respect for, decided to put Syria on the back burner because he did not want to get involved in a Middle East conflict. It was a long-term strategic mistake, as we now see. And ISIS were allowed to flourish and flourish and flourish, and their caliphate in Raqqa now is really the focus of President Trump. I mean, I think that he was horrified by the images of children choking to death last week from the sarin attack. But I also think he was largely motivated, as there are many in his administration, they blur the lines between the war on ISIS and the war against the Syrian people.
Well, I think this clarity is really, because obviously we're going to be thinking and reading a lot about Syria in the next few weeks.
Yeah.
So I think that's really important. I do want to say this about your book. You chronicle what I think of as this just determination of Syrians who want Assad gone, and as you say, want the dignity of living in a democratic society. And they continue this in the face of torture and destruction and this hell that they have been subjected to. I mean, it's really extraordinary to read about the courage of average Syrians who refuse to be driven out and refuse to be cowed by what Assad's visiting on them.
You know, human beings are resilient. And I think during wartime, ordinary people become heroes. And I've seen this time and time again in all the conflicts I've covered, from Bosnia, Rwanda, Afghanistan, Iraq. And Syria is such a brutal conflict. And I have to, you know, I lecture a lot around the U.S. and around the world. And I always say to people, especially to students, I think people don't understand what it's like to live without the pillars of democracy. And the pillars of democracy are freedom of expression, rule of law, and human rights. So imagine that you really can't write a newspaper article criticizing President Trump. Imagine that you can't demonstrate publicly or you will be put down with bullets. Imagine that you are not protected by the law, that one day, which is the title of my book, is The Morning They Came for Us. And basically, you know, everyone I talk to, I would say, what happened to you? And they would say, well, the morning they came to get me. Mm-hmm. And imagine that. It's 6 a.m., you're waking up, and there's a knock on the door, and you're dragged off to a police station. Your parents, your family, your husband, your children can do nothing to protect you because there is no protection for you. There is no human rights. There is no rule of law. And you're thrown into a pit in some jail, and you're never heard from again. And you're tortured brutally. And, you know, I know that this is hard to hear, but this is what I just have. I really want people to understand this, that we live in a democracy. For all the criticism we have of our country, we live in a place where we're allowed to express ourselves and we're allowed to say what we want, as long as it doesn't incite, you know, hatred or racism. But these people do not. And that's what they were demonstrating for. That's what the Arab Spring was about. It wasn't about, it was about getting your dignity and getting the things as human beings that we should have, that we're born with. So I know it's a real stretch for people to kind of put themselves in the shoes of Syrian people, but that's what I really tried to do in my book. And that's what I really, you know, ask people to do when they say to me, what can we do to help? What can we do to help these kids, you know, that are in besieged cities, mm-hmm. or women that have been raped, or refugees? You know, you have to kind of take a moment and put yourself into their shoes.
I was having a conversation not too long ago with Elliot Ackerman, novelist, mm-hmm. yeah, and journalist.
Yeah.
And as you know, he's written a lot about Syria. And he said that in quiet moments with Syrian friends, whom he's known for a long time, they will openly ask themselves whether this quest for democracy, with all of its nobility and, you know, and righteousness of it, was worth it. I wonder if you hear friends in Syria reflect on that now.
Sure. It's the same in Iraq. I mean, you know, people will say, well, back in the Saddam days, and Saddam was evil, evil incarnate, but they could send their kids to school. You know, you weren't stuck in a traffic jam and feared that a car bomb was going to go off next to you and you'd be trapped in traffic and you'd be blown to smithereens. And I think, you know, 7 years of war. I lived through the siege of Sarajevo, which was 3 years. Now, 3 years going through, you know, not having heat, electricity, all of the basic things that human beings need to live is a long time. 7 years, that's the lifetime, that's a grammar school education of a child. You know, I mean, I just can't stress how broken people are after that time. I think you're going to get different thoughts. I think there are people who will think, you know, a struggle is worth it and there's a long term benefit in the end, that they will overthrow Assad, that they will have a different country. But you see, with the rise of ISIS, the future of Syria is very precarious. And I'm not sure that a partition of the country will work. You also have the Kurdish question, which is a whole other dimension. A friend of mine calls, you know, looking at what Syria will look like in the future, a 3D chess game. You know, that it's so, there's so many moving players. Is it worth it? I mean, I think that comes down to the individuals. I think if you talk to a woman in her, I worked quite a lot with refugees for the UNHCR in 2014, specifically with women who were alone because their husbands were either killed in Syria or they were fighting, and these women had taken their children under their arms and walked or took buses or got, you know, hitchhiked to the borders of Lebanon or Turkey, or some of them went to Iraq or Egypt.
Wow.
And I would sit with them in the camps for hours and talk to them, you know, about their future, what they were going to do, would they ever go back. You know, refugees need to go back, to go home. They need to go to a safe place. So no one is going to go back now while war is waging, while ISIS are kidnapping and raping and beheading, and also why the barrel bombs are falling. So I think, first of all, we need to secure the country so that it's safe for civilians. And I think, again, what you said earlier, you know, we need to bring this question of the Syria question back to the Syrian civilian people. And President Trump did the right thing with airstrikes. And a lot of people would say, you know, are we getting involved in a new war in the Middle East? I think that humanitarian intervention could have, you know, way back in 2013 after the Ghouta attacks, had we sent a key message to President Assad saying, you are not going to get away with this. You will not be allowed to murder civilians with impunity. We would have seen a whole different tide of the war. And once the Russians got involved in 2015, you know, there was a huge shift then. Then it was very clear that Assad, aided by Iranian-backed Hezbollah and by Russia, was winning. Now we're going to see a change. You know, I think the strategy has changed, the future of Syria. We can see it more, what might happen. But we have to remember that there's nearly 500,000 people that are dead.
Wow.
There's 11 million refugees and displaced people. And I think we have to think of those people.
Janine, a pleasure to hear from you again. And
great
and
to talk to you.
To get the benefit of your reporting and your experience. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Janine DiGiovanni is the author of The Morning They Came for Us, her experience on reporting in Syria.